This is Equestrian Legacy Radio.
I love them from the start. They're in my veins, running my blood. And if I live to be 100, I'll never get enough. They fill our days, they grace our lives. Our links on the same chain. The kindred spirits everywhere. This love of horses that we share. Some pinto, some sorrows, the ponies, the pasos, palominos, they're in my dreams, they keep me smiling, yeah. When I go on to the next life, I know I'll be riding. Our days, they grace our lives. Our hearts beat the same. Those of us who feel this way are links on the same chain. Kindred spirits everywhere. This love of horses that we share.
Equestrian Legacy Radio. I'm your host, Gary Holt. Welcome to our first show of 2014. Today we'll be talking with the former chairman of Backcountry Horsemen of America, Alan Hill, and the newly elected vice president of the Pleasure Horse Division with the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders and Exhibitors Association, Jesse LeBeck. When we come back, we'll visit with Alan Hill.
I'm leaving to go back home where the short grass grows. I'm going where the short grass grows. mountains rise and the wind always blows. A place big enough for a man to dream. Back home where the short grass grows. The Lord never painted a prettier sky, almost as blue as the blue of her eyes. When we shared our love by the piñon fire's glow, back home where the short grass grows. I'm going where the short grass grows. Blue mountains rise and the wind always blows. A place big enough for a man to dream. Back home where the short grass grows. Where the ponies run wild like the wind in her hair. When I close my eyes I can almost be there. I can see my love awaiting where that old sweet water flows. Back home where the short grass grows. I'm going where the short grass grows. Blue mountains rise and the wind always blows. Place big enough for a man to dream. Back home where the short grass grows.
The short grass is a-waving to a turquoise sky above. The aspen-covered hills guard the country that I love. I'm going where the short grass grows. The blue mountains rise and the wind always blows. A place big enough for a man to dream. Back home where the short grass grows. My home where the short grass grows. The short grass grows.
You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we'd like to welcome now to the show Alan Hill. Alan, how are you doing?
Fine, Gary. Good morning to you. Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you, and I appreciate very much you joining us today on the show. For our listeners, we want to remind you that the first Thursday of each month, we're happy to have Backcountry Horsemen of America join us. And Alan is the former chairman of Backcountry Horsemen, and so we're just tickled to death to have you with us. Alan, we visited before, and you're just a fascinating person to talk to, but when you were on the show a few months ago, really didn't get to find out much about you and how you got started with horses and your background. Can you share some information about yourself with us?
Okay, Gary. Actually, I am a professional civil engineer. That's my business. I grew up in the engineering and surveying business. And been one ever since. As a young boy, many of the projects that we had were survey projects in remote parts of the country in Northern California, and we used stock horses and mules to move and supply our survey camps in remote parts of the area where hydro projects or dams or power lines were being built, part of the time any roads were built. So I kind of grew up in the business of engineering and around stock, and it's become a passion of mine over the years to see if we can perpetuate the use of pack and saddle stock, and we do that in a variety of different ways.
Well, did you have a love for horses when you were a young fellow? When did you get started with horses?
No, Gary, I did have a love from the first time I got on a horse, I guess when I was about 6 years old. Even though I got bucked off, I still went back and repeated my mistakes until I could finally could finally learn about it. But yes, I had a passion for them from the first.
Well, now, were most of your use with horses, did you just pleasure ride? Did you ever get involved in any kind of competitions? Or where did you grow up? In Northern California?
I grew up in Northern California, here in Redding. I've worked and lived all over the country, but every time my wife and I were in a different location, we decided Redding was the place to live. Our family's been here forever. So we're back here in California and have been now for many years. I did compete a little bit, not well, but I basically just look at horses as a way to perpetuate my use of wilderness areas, hunting and fishing, and now we've expanded that into a worthwhile, productive thing with the land management agencies to support the trail crews that are required to keep our trails open in the backcountry.
Yeah. Well, when did you get started with Backcountry Horsemen of America? How did that come about?
You know, Gary, I'm not sure of the dates. I believe that the Backcountry Horsemen of California as an organization was formed, I believe, in 1988. I joined in 1990 and became the chapter president and then became the national director to the Backcountry Horsemen of America sometime in the mid-90s and served as chair from 1999 to 2011. But the interest that I had is that we can complain about the trails not being maintained and all those kind of things, but unless we have the influence to make that point at the national level and through the agencies, we decided we weren't going to get very far. We have also, I think, a strong interest in reconnecting with many of the land managers, anti-horse attitudes of the past, and education of horsemen in general. We find that the best salesmen for our position are people who do know horses, but at the same time we have many people who support us to a great degree who don't own a horse, but just have the interest in hiking or trails in general and public access to public lands. So we take our mission pretty seriously.
Well, you know, I think we spoke before, and I'm back here in Tennessee, back here in the eastern part of the United States. Our systems are a little bit different than what they are as you go west. And how did Backcountry Horsemen actually get started?
Actually, Backcountry Horsemen of America was started in Columbia Falls, Montana, 40 years ago, with the intent of helping the agencies, at that time the Forest Service, maintain some of the trails in the Bob Marshall Wilderness Area. It was a focus of how can we help, not how can we continue to fight the agencies with budget issues and staff issues. So the group took on a challenge of rebuilding a bridge in the Bob Marshall area that was required for access into the Bob Marshall Wilderness, and completed it very successfully, and it grew from there. The Backcountry Horsemen at that time was Montana, then Idaho, then the state of Washington, and then California, with the same commitment to that mission of service and volunteerism and partnership as a way to help educate the public about what we do and the need to maintain the heritage of our trail systems.
Well, I think that recently with the government shutdown that we had back in the fall, people all across the country became keenly aware of how keeping our trails open is so important for people, whether you're out in the west, whether you're back in the eastern parts of the state. And of course, finances play a big role in how many trails are open and what kind of use is available for people. I know that we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. There was a GAO study that was done, and what did that show?
Well, Gary, the GAO study basically pointed out the huge number of miles of trails that haven't been worked or haven't been maintained for many years. The backlog, the deferred backlog, is huge. And if you take a look at the trends that you can say in the future, or we're heading, is that it shows a much larger number of users using those trails, with a declining, a substantially larger declining number of dollars or commitment to maintain those trails. So, you know, it's a perfect storm for having more people, more use, and less ability to access most of these areas. It's a it's a serious problem. We were pleased with the commitment that came from several of the congressmen to ask for this study from the GAO. That has come about, and we are using that to reemphasize, I guess, our concerns about how these trails will be maintained in the future. It's not just budget issues, although that's a huge part of it, but it's a commitment. And the commitment is the responsibility of the land management agencies who have the charge to keep these access, public land access issues resolved. And across the country, we found, whether it's the East, the Midwest, Rockies, or the West, California, and the coast, that the problems are the same. The dollars just have not been spent to either maintain on an annual basis or improve or maintain some of those areas that were, due to storm damage or lack of maintenance, have effectively closed miles and miles of our backcountry trails and front country trails. So excuse me, Gary, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I think probably this last year, with the fires that we had and then with the flooding that we've had in some parts of the country, particularly out in the West, that's just compounded the problem.
Really has, and there's been a kind of an interesting byproduct of that, in that where these trails have been effectively closed due to lack of maintenance, logs down or slides or bridges going out, that when fires occur in those areas, then, as you know, smoke and fire issues never stay in the same place, so it precludes a lot of access by air or by other methods to get into some of the backcountry unless the trails are open.
Right.
So all of a sudden, it's become apparent that unless access is maintained on an annual basis, fires can roll through hundreds of thousands of acres without any degree of control or attempt to resolve any of the ways where those fires can be fought effectively. So it's becoming more apparent that we're not talking about just access; we're talking about protecting a resource. And when we lose the hundreds of thousands of acres, as we have in the West in parts of the country over the years, it's a disaster waiting to happen. And then that's compounded with the issue of the bug-infested trees in the Rocky Mountains that have caused blocks of land that are, again, in the hundreds of thousands of acres of dead trees, which is nothing but a fire hazard waiting to happen.
Right, right. I guess a lot of that is due to what, the pine beetle?
Pine beetle has been a big problem, yes.
Yeah, I know that there were a lot of areas back here in the eastern part of the country that caused a lot of problems and issues where we lost trees to the pine beetle and trail closures. And, of course, it takes people and money to get those trails opened up again and I suppose to replant and replace those trees that have been lost, which is, you know, part of our part of the asset that we're talking about as far as our natural assets are concerned. You know, when we talked the last time, you had some stories that you were telling about involvement with young people and some extended trips back into the backcountry with supplies, and I think you sent me some information about a an area that recently was in the Trinity Alps Wilderness in California that had a tremendous amount of resources that were brought in. And I'd like, when we come back, to talk about that and how that was helped and what the value of that was. But let's take just a quick break, and when we come back, let's find out a little bit more about what's going on with our trails as we talk with Alan Hill. And we'll be back in just a moment.
It's a perfect day to lose our way, watching the world drifting by, living without asking why. What will be, it's a mystery. I knew there is no need to explain. It'll all wash away in the rain. So let it go where it will flow. Leave all the stars far behind till you lose all track of time. What that really means, anything, everything, we'll never know till we try. Let's go wandering past the wondering why, under a rolling sky.
Under a Rolling Sky with our friend Michael Martin Murphy. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, Alan, people that enjoy getting out and riding the trails, we enjoy being able to get out under these rolling skies like he was just singing about. We don't really realize what might be at risk until some of those trails are closed, and maybe a little bit late sometimes we decide that we need to get involved. Because we're in danger of losing something. Can you talk to us a little bit about the partnerships that are in place with Backcountry Horsemen and some of the agencies? And I believe that there was just something that was done with the Wilderness Society that I know the Walking Horse Breeders Association has signed on to. But just talk to us about those things for just a bit.
Okay, Gary, I'll try to kind of briefly hit the highlights, because it's a huge subject that you're talking about. Bottom line, though, I believe is that it's important that we all recognize that trails and our resources don't get maintained without work, and then budgets being involved and what they are. it's apparent to us and most of other people, such as the Wilderness Society, as you mentioned, the Conservation Corps crews, the agencies, that without changing the mode of operation that's been in place for the last probably almost 100 years, where the agencies had the responsibility, had the budget, had the staff to do the work themselves, we need to expand our efforts and vision to include active, responsible partnership roles with all those we can, and how can we leverage those participation partnership participations to be either more grant eligible or be able to accomplish the work in a manner that has not been done before, with the demise of the staff of the agencies and the budget difficulties. So, Backcountry Horsemen, I think you're asking about Backcountry Horsemen in California, but this is true across the country today, have been increasingly involved with the use of youth crews, and the youth crews include the Conservation Corps crews, the Northwest Youth Corps, and a variety of other youth organizations, as well as people like the Sierra Club and, to a degree, the American Horse Council and the organizations such as Pacific Crest Trail Association and the Continental Divide Association, who have the interest. We have a common interest. So how can we best leverage those common interests into a viable program where we can use what we each do best to accomplish, at least make an attempt to establish a pattern or model, if you will, of how it can be done. Backcountry Horsemen have had an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, with the four agencies, BLM, Forest Service, Park Service, and Corps of Engineers for many years. We've expanded on that in different parts of the country to include either a memorandum of understanding or a partnership agreement with a youth group such as the California Conservation Corps or the conservation corps across the country that are now collaborating under the term of the Public Land Service Corporation and, more importantly, today, the 21st Century Conservation Corps organization that's in formation and becoming very active. So how does this work? Well, where we first started to try to visualize how we could better be, as an organization, be better and more effective, we were fortunate to have the leader of the California Conservation Corps Backcountry Program, one of the leaders within the Forest Service as trail manager of one of the forests, and ourselves set aside a day to try to develop a plan, how we could have a plan of work that could be each of us could accomplish. Well, we first had to divide up the responsibilities and find out who was going to do what, where, when. And Backcountry Horsemen at that time were needed most in areas where we could provide pack stock and logistics support for the trail crews, whether they be operating out of a trailhead camp or whether they be operating out of a spike camp someplace or a backcountry camp. And so we made that commitment to, at least in parts of the country, make that commitment to fulfill our responsibilities if the Forest Service could provide the leadership, identify the projects with our participation, and the California Conservation Corps or the other Conservation Corps crews that could provide the staff. Well, the staff of youth varies substantially, and typically a spike camp crew working out of a front country location would consist of anywhere from 8 to 12 youth plus a supervisor, who may either camp at the trailhead or may have what they call an eight-day spike in the backcountry to work out of. The backcountry program, that's kind of the elite program, at least in California, consists of 12 backcountry crews of 15 to 18 people, youth from age 18 to 23, and each one of those six backcountry crews has their own Forest Service person assigned to it. And they work from May until September in the backcountry. They literally don't typically come out unless it's to relocate to a different camp. So they're operating, without all of the benefits of civilization, running water, electricity, and all those kind of things. And they're camping. There's a cook assigned to that camp. And each one of those camps is a substantial logistic move to make the move. It requires anywhere from in excess of 25 mules plus packers to move a camp. And every weekend there's an 8 to 10 mule train resupply for each one of those camps that is going to require food, mail, and supplies and tools and so forth. So,
Alan, let me ask this question again, because, you know, out here in the East, we're not familiar with some of these things. How far back in the backcountry are these young people?
Well, the backcountry program is typically, I would say, at least a minimum of 6 or 7 miles, and it can be as much as 20 or 25 miles. One camp we were supplying last year was a 27-mile round trip in and out of to the camp.
Wow.
So it's a long ways, and it can be high-elevation camps and, you know, up to 9,000 feet, and it's rough country, and it's, you know, in high, rocky, granite country. Some of those camps down the southern Sierras are even higher elevation than that. But each one of them is remote, even though one that's maybe back there 5 miles from the nearest trailhead. Access is typically with a four-wheel drive dirt road to get up a steep mountain road to get to the trailhead, and then from there, you're going a long ways.
Right, right. So where do these young people come from that get involved in these programs?
That selection process I'm familiar with is a really an interesting story itself. There's Of course, access to the website has attracted a lot of people, but we have seen people come from literally all over the country, from New York to Florida to New Jersey, just running through my memory of the kids that were here last year in our part of the country. Some from the South, several had just completed a four-year degree in school and wanted to take a break and work hard for a year and then figure out what they're going to do. But they come from all over the country. They'll come on a Greyhound bus, and of course they're interviewed by telephone. And if they have further interest, they'll get on a bus and or an airplane or drive. Or very few of them have cars at that age, of course.
Right.
And come to a center where they're processed and go through a briefing of what the requirements are, and a fairly selective criteria for those who are actually hired. Then the first week they're put through a kind of a mini training program, and then they're ready to go to work. And it's a fascinating social evolution that you experience working with these kids through the year. Here they come out of a large city someplace, perhaps, and don't have any idea what the mountains are, let alone the conditions, the rough conditions, the elevation, high elevation. But when they first show up, they're inexperienced. And as the season evolves, they're learning to live and work as a community. They have educational requirements. They have a library that goes with their camp that they're expected to use and go through a series of seminars at night about what they need to learn, and they live and work together for 5 months.
Wow!
And
wow!
They basically have to learn to live and work as a community, be productive members of the community, and they pay for their they're paid essentially not much more than a minimum wage, but they have the opportunity to get a scholarship from AmeriCorps that varies from $2,500 upon graduation or upon completion of a season, and minimal food expenses. And there is a contribution by the different suppliers for boots and tents and things like that for those kids, so they don't have to come out of pocket with more than what they don't have anyway.
Wow.
To participate. But it's an evolution that we have seen and is a part of the fascinating experience we have participating with those programs through the year, to see when thrown in an extremely difficult environment that most people would consider a difficult environment, know, it rains and snows in almost every month of the year in this country. It gets hot. There's rattlesnakes. There's bears. There's all these things that exist in the woods that people are not necessarily aware of or experienced or want to learn about. but that's
gosh.
That's a part of life that they learn to live and appreciate.
Yeah. Hey, Alan, we have joined us on the call, and I'm going to bring her on a little bit early, is Jesse LeBack, who is the Vice President for the Pleasure Horse Division. And, Jesse, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. I want to introduce you to Alan Hill. And, Alan, this is Jesse. Jesse is going to be involved with the Backcountry Horseman program through the Pleasure Division, and I know she was not expecting to be on the line at this time, but I thought I would just open the line up for her, and she might have some questions, but I think it's pretty fascinating as our discussion has taken the direction that it has about these young folks that have gotten involved in this type of program, and she's also been involved with the youth program with the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders Association. So, Jesse, if you have any questions, I'm going to just let you pipe in if you'd like at some point in time. But, Alan, let's go back, and I wanted to ask this question. You said that these kids found something on the website. Is that the Backcountry Horsemen of America website, or what website would they go to apply to get into this program?
You know, I'm not sure what it is across the country, but there is a Public Land Service Corporation website, I believe, that's based in Durango, Colorado. Harry Bruel is the man who runs that program. The person that I'm most familiar with is in California, and I believe the California Conservation Corps website is the one that most use. Now, I can verify that for you, Jesse, and give you some better information on that off the cuff, though. I think if you'd pull up the California Conservation Corps website, and I'm not just selling the California Corps, but as an example of how some of these kids can be put to work. But there's a Student Conservation Educational Association, SCEA, the Northwest Youth Corps, and different conservation corps by state that are certainly worth considering and talking about. There is a push at the national level by the agencies, and the Forest Service is very involved in implementing the 21st Century Conservation Corps program that is in startup mode. I believe there's a website of the 21st Century Conservation Corps that might be worth taking a look at also.
Well, I think it would be fascinating if some of our youth with the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders Association spent 3 or 4 or 5 months back in the backcountry and were able to participate in a program like this. It could be interesting.
I think it would be an opportunity that you know, we're all looking for, is to kind of spread the word on how the program works, and you put one of those kids or several of them on a program for 5 months. They know the details well, and they can usually speak very enthusiastically about their success.
Well, I think that's an opportunity that might be there. You know, you sent an email, and we talked about this a little bit during one of the breaks, Alan, about Trinity Alps Wilderness in Northern California. There was something that some numbers that you shared with me that were just pretty amazing about how much food and supplies were taken back during a period of time. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Gary. The Trinity Alps is a 550,000 acre wilderness in our backyard. We're fortunate, as I mentioned earlier, to have almost 1 million acres of wilderness right here in our backyard in the northwest of Reading, where we live. But the 550,000-acre Trinity Alps is a high mountain, very rough, very steep section of wilderness that has been used since the Gold Rush days. Matter of fact, a lot of the old gold mines are still visible. But the trail system, there's 550 miles of wilderness trails in that 550,000 acres, interestingly enough. And our organization, the Shasta Trinity Unit of the Backcountry Horsemen of California, has responsibility to work with the Forest Service on our commitment with the Conservation Corps kids as to what we can do to support their program for trail maintenance. And our unit's a fairly small unit, about 200 members, but this last year our members contributed over 285 stock days to support the 15 to 17 member backcountry trail crews with the California Conservation Corps in the Alps. That 285 stock days represents each day that stock is used, whether it's pack stock or saddle stock, is one day. If it takes a day to get there and a day to get back, you're only paid for the day. I mean, you only count the day that they're in use, and that may mean a 27-mile round trip day. It may mean a 14, 15-hour day. But the mules don't know the difference, and the horses don't know the difference. It's just the way we need to keep tab of what we can do. So out of those 285 stock days, that incidentally did not include our fish plant program that takes another 50, 60 head of stock to plant some of the high mountain lakes with fingerlings. But out of those 285 stock days, a total of 25,050 pounds of food, camp supplies, tools, and mail was packed on our mules from late May through mid-September. So if Wow. there was a commercial value to that, where the agency, the Forest Service, would have to hire commercial packers to do that, that value is approaching $100,000.
Wow.
So it's a major contribution and a major commitment we make, where every weekend, some of our members are signed up, in usually by the 1st of June, to make the camp moves. And each camp move, as I mentioned, is 25 head of pack mules. Each resupply could be as high as 12 pack mules, plus the packers and the stock they ride. So it's a big commitment. But it sounds like a lot of work. It is a lot of work. But if you can't make these things fun, then you're probably doing the wrong thing. And it is a lot of fun because you have the opportunity to relate and work with these kids. You can see them when you come into camp with those long strings of mules. They rush over and find where the mail is first. They help unload the mail, and then they get down to the food next. But their participation and wanting to learn, and all of a sudden their fear of stock seems to, in general, evaporate. So you might wind up with that much stock and a bunch of dogs that everybody has running around there together. It's kind of an exciting thing for those kids to see, the first visitors they may have had for a week. So it is a fascinating experience. But in our opinion, the value added is probably the hidden value. Is the value it adds to the youth's lives and the direction
right.
it provides them in their future. If they can accomplish what they do, both personally and from a hard work standpoint, in a period of a few months, doesn't that set a pattern for their life that they can use those same experiences to in their future to become successful?
Well, I think that's a tremendous opportunity. It's doing a tremendous amount of good as far as the service that they're providing, but the educational and life experiences they get is just unbelievable. And one of the things that Jesse and I may talk about a little bit in the second segment of this program is getting youth involved and keeping them involved in horse activities early on and for a lifetime. And this certainly is a type of program that could contribute to something like that. I'm sure, Alan, as these programs go forward, probably more young people and young adults need to be involved because folks like you and I are getting a little bit older. It's hard for us
well,
to keep those things
up. And we're looking for all the help we can get, Gary. At least I am.
goodness. Well, Jesse, do you have any questions you'd like to ask Alan while...
Well, I want to know how many walking horses he's using out there.
I don't know that I can answer that. I can tell you we have some.
Oh, well, good. That's what I want to hear.
And I can tell you something else. We have some crossbred mules that got a little walking horse in them. I mean, it's an embarrassment to the mules, maybe. But
very good.
Make a great cross.
It does make a good cross. It really does. It really does. Mm-hmm. Well, Alan, we've taken up all your time today, and again, we are really happy to have a partnership with Equestrian Legacy Radio and Backcountry Horsemen of America to keep our listeners, our audience, informed as to what's going on, to keep our trails open, and we need to get involved as horse people across the country to support these efforts to do that. And could you join us again next month?
I'd be happy to, Gary. If I can contribute anything, I'd be happy to do that. And I would offer to Jesse, I don't need to do it now, but if you have any questions about access to any of these Conservation Corps programs, please give me a call or email me. I'd be happy to help point you in a direction, because I'm convinced, as you can tell, I'm convinced that the youth are our future here with what we try to do.
Definitely. Well, I'm sure we'll be in touch.
All right. Well, that's great. Well, I'm glad we could connect you two today on the program. And, Alan, thanks again for taking your time to join us. We look forward to having you back next month. And let's kind of pick up where we left off today, talking more about the partnership programs that are in place and how people can get involved. Could you give us one time Backcountry Horsemen of America's website address?
Backcountry Horsemen of America.
.org? Is that a .org?
If you just pull up Backcountry Horsemen of America, you'll get there.
Okay. All right. Well, we want to encourage our...
If you have any trouble with it, Gary, just email me and I'll get you. But if you pull up Backcountry Horsemen of America, then that will also... our website is being updated. Everybody updates their website frequently. We need to do it more often, and we are redoing it. So apologize for the current status of it, but... There are links to the different state organizations that
okay.
have backcountry horsemen involved state chapters, and there are 26 chapters across the country of the state organizations of Backcountry Horsemen of America. So I think you can probably pull that up, and it's okay. I probably shouldn't say much about it, but it's not modern or updated as it should be yet.
All right. Well, I'm sure that is in the process. And by the way, if you go to our website, equestrianlegacy.net, there is a logo on our homepage for Backcountry Horsemen of America. And if you click on that, that will take you to their website. So equestrianlegacy.net, and just click on the Backcountry Horsemen logo, and that will take you right to their website. So, Alan, once again, thanks for joining us today, and look forward to having you back with us next week. And I hope you get some rain out there in California. I know you need it.
We need it, Gary. I appreciate the chance to speak, and look forward to next week.
All right. All right. Look forward to talking with you again soon. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Jesse Lebeck.
She talks about them, dreams about them, thinks about them all the time. She's got to have them, be lost without them. You can see it in her eyes. What is it? What is it with girls and horses? She said, now when I was a young girl, they were my whole world. They were my one safe place. Now that I'm older, still I talk about him and I dream about him. I live to love him and I love to ride. I'll always have him, be lost without him. There's magic in those animals. What is it? What is
That's Girls and Horses by Templeton Thompson, and you're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio. And today we're happy to have joining us Jesse Lebeck, who is the owner of Self-Made Farms in North Carolina, and she is also the newly elected Vice President for the Pleasure Horse Division with the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders and Exhibitors Association. So, Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You just were not expecting to be brought in to talk to Alan Hill just a minute ago. So glad you got to meet him on the program today. But we want to talk about you because we're talking in January with some amazing horsewomen, and this is Cowgirls Rule during the month of January on Equestrian Legacy Radio. And so we're happy to have you on the show, but if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started with horses.
Okay, well, my family had horses because we field trialed with bird dogs. And even before then, I had had an affinity for them, is what I'm told. And we got into the field trialing, and when I was about 7, my parents bought me my first pony, and I fell off of her all the time. And my mom decided it was time for some riding lessons. So we were actually living in Western New York at that point, and I went to a farm called Bridgman Stables, and they taught me how to ride. And we rode a little bit of everything. They had mammoth mules that they competed with at a pretty high level, and there was quarter horses, Arabians, draft crosses. They put us on everything. And so I learned hunt seat and western there. And when I was 9, we made the move to North Carolina. And a friend of ours down here found out I liked horses and suggested the local 4-H club. And I got involved with 4-H. And everyone in my 4-H club had hunt seat ponies. So at the time, I thought that I wanted a hunt seat pony. And we had some walkers or gated horses, nothing registered yet at the time. And I decided that I wanted to start showing. So my mom almost caved in and let me get into the hunt seat ponies, but she decided that wasn't what I was going to do. And she pointed at her field trial horse that was out in the pasture, and she said, "You want to show? Well, there's a horse. Go ahead.
All right.
We'll see how you do." And so I started showing him 4-H and actually won at the state level with him. And after about a year of showing him, I had convinced them that I was serious about it, and they bought me my first registered walking horse. And it's just escalated since then.
Wow. And how old were you then?
I was 12 when they bought me my first horse. I was 12 and he was 2.
All right.
Well, that was quite together.
A combination. Yeah, quite a combination to have a 12-year-old girl with a 2-year-old horse. So that was all right. So you started with 4-H and then you progressed into what, open shows from that point?
I did. When I first started around here, NWHA, the National Walking Horse Association, was getting pretty popular. And they had a lot of all flatshod shows. So we ended up going to quite a few of those shows. and I really enjoyed that for some time. They've sort of, they're not as popular around here anymore as they used to be. And we, I'm trying to think, I think 2006 was the first time we went out to Tennessee to show to the International. And once I got a taste of that, it was all over. I was hooked. So.
Oh, goodness. Well, that can do it to you when you get back here into in Tennessee and start competing a little bit with some of the shows here. So what part of North Carolina are you in?
We're in eastern North Carolina. We're about an hour straight east of Raleigh.
Okay. And let me ask this question, because I know I've talked with some folks before, and we talked a little bit when Alan was on earlier about having young people that get involved and then stay involved. We had Chris Herman out in California that was on a few months ago, and we were talking about the fact that she was real active when she was a youngster, and then college came in and kind of messed that up a little bit. Did that happen to you?
Well, I thought it was going to, and about a month before I was supposed to go, I cried almost every day because I thought that, you know, the horse thing was just going to have to go on hold. But I was lucky. I went to North Carolina State, which is just in Raleigh, about an hour from us. And my parents were very nice and took care of my horses for me while I was there. And I would come home every weekend. And I actually taught riding lessons while I was still in school. And by the time I got out of school, I had boarding horses that I was keeping here and had built up the riding lesson business, so that when I came out of school, I went straight into running the barn. So I was very lucky.
Wow. And so how did the name Self-Made Farm come about?
Well, when we went to Tennessee one year to buy, well, we weren't, of course, you're never going to buy a horse, but somehow you always come home with one. And we had gone to, I had a horse by Extra Cash, so we wanted to go meet Bonnie Katie and see Extra Cash. And she had a two-year-old there that we fell in love with, and his full brother was a self-made man, and the horse we bought was named Extra's Self-Made. So we brought him home, and we sort of had a lot of hopes for him. And when we were trying to decide what to name the farm, Self-Made Farm came up. And then the more we talked about it, we decided that it was very fitting because we pretty much do everything ourselves around here. And we built the barn, we built the stalls, you know, we build everything ourselves. And so we decided that just fit. So.
Well, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool way to name a place. So tell us a little bit about Self-Made Farm. What do you do there?
Well, we board a little bit, and we're actually right now getting more into the training side of things. We just recently built four more stalls on, so we've got a 13-stall barn now, which we started with five, so we've grown quite a bit.
Right.
And so the main thing we do is the training with the flat-shod horses. And then I have a riding lesson program that I've been doing since I was about 15.
All right.
We do quite a few lessons here.
Talk to me about the riding lesson program, and how did you get started with that, and what kind of students do you have?
Well, I got started, like I said, I was 15, and our veterinarian, our small animal vet's daughter, wanted to learn to ride, and her mom said to me, she said, "Don't you want to teach her?" So I agreed, and I had a hard time at first because I did not want to share my horses with other people. But I got past that, and so she was my very first student, and she rode with me probably right up until she graduated high school. She was about 8 years old when she started, I think, and it just sort of grew from there. I decided I liked teaching, and it was a good way for me to make some extra money but still be around the horses versus going to get, you know, a summer job or something like that.
Right.
So I decided I liked it, and I've just kept on with it, and it's grown, and I've been fortunate to have some really good young ladies come through. We're a little short on the gentlemen around here right now, but We try to encourage them.
Well, you know, I've always told people, as a young guy, that it was to your advantage to get involved with horses because it seemed that every little girl wanted a horse. So if you want to meet
exactly.
young ladies, you know, you need to be riding horses. So, you know.
That's what we tell them.
Yeah, you need to spread that word over there a little bit. Are most of your students youth, or do you have some adults that are students that get involved?
We do. I have some adults. I actually had one lady. My mom grooms dogs here, and
okay.
everything's here at the barn and everything. So she was a customer of my mom's, and when she retired, she decided she wanted to ride horses. Mom told her, you know, she needed to talk to me and that I could get her riding, and she was a little nervous about it. She actually has a degenerative spine condition, so her doctor was a little leery of her riding, but once I explained to her, you know, the walking horses turned out to just be perfect for her and what she needed.
Right.
So she started taking some lessons, and first it was once a week, then it was 2 days a week, then it was 3 days a week, and finally I told her she needed to just buy her own horse. I told her she was going to wear my lesson horses out. So.
Oh, goodness.
I convinced her. She did not think she needed a horse. I don't think she ever thought she was going to buy a horse, but I found we got really lucky, found this really nice mare up in West Virginia, and she bought her, and this past year was their first year really showing. I talked to her in the horse shows too, and
okay.
She went out to the international and took reserve out of 18 in one class.
Oh, wow.
And then got a first place in the novice class.
Wow. Wow. So she learned her lesson well.
Further. Yeah. She took this riding thing a lot further than she ever thought she would.
Oh, gracious. Well, we want to talk more about your students and what you've been doing with that, but I have a song that we wanted to play for you since you're from North Carolina. And this one was one that I thought was very appropriate. It's a song called Carolina in the Pines by Michael Martin Murphy. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Jessie a little bit more about her students and her involvement in the walking horses and how she got them involved. And you're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio.
She'd known me a long time, and she spoke of being in love with every mountain she had climbed, and she talked of trails she'd walked up far above the timberline. From that night on, I knew I'd write songs. And the full moon in the last week brings a fullness to this earth. There's no guesswork in the clockwork of the world's heart or mine. There are nights I only feel right with Carolina in the pines. Thank you.
You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and that's Caroline in the Pines by Michael Martin Murphy. And we're talking with Jesse LeBeck. And how are you doing?
I'm fine.
All right. All right. Did that make you feel at home?
It did.
Well, good, good. Well, we were talking a little bit about some of your showing just before that break. Talk to us about your folks, the kids that you've gotten involved in showing, and I guess you came down for the international and probably the versatility show. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure, we did. I do have some of the kids that do travel with us to Tennessee. Everyone's level of showing sort of depends on how far they want to travel and what their budget is. We've got several good open circuits around here close to us that I'll take some of my younger kids to. And I've got some that do the 4-H circuit, and then I've got a couple that go with us to the bigger shows and show at the national level. This year we spent 12 days at the end of July out in Murfreesboro. We were there for the World Versatility Show, the National Futurity, the International, and we drove over and showed a couple horses at Wartrace. Race. So
wow.
We hit everything we could while we were in town.
Well, and talk to us a little bit about the Versatility Show. How many folks or how much involvement did you have with that, and what areas do you compete in?
Well, we do a little bit of everything. We brought 10 horses with us to Tennessee this year, and we showed about 7 of them in the World Versatility Show. And I actually had a horse that we had sold to a lady in Kentucky. She brought him down for me to show in the versatility events, and we pretty much did a little bit of everything. We showed showmanship, model, trail obstacle, western riding, dressage, western dressage, hunter hack over fences. We showed on the rail. We did equitation and horsemanship. And I think that was everything I rode that horse in.
Wow, wow. Well, I mean, it's really versatile. That's why we call it versatility, because the horses can participate in so many different events. In that, do you have a favorite event that you like to participate in?
I have to say showmanship is my favorite, which a lot of people don't like it, but I just love it it's something where if you just really pay attention to the details and really break down the patterns and just get really picky with it, you can really do well. And it's always been my favorite. So.
Okay. Did you and I talk about reining at some point in time in the past?
Have
you ever gotten involved in the reining?
I dabbled a little bit. I've actually worked with some reining trainers over the years, on and off. And I actually had a horse when they first added the jackpot to the World Versatility Show. I had a horse that I was getting ready, and he tripped one day and fell with me and broke my foot.
Oh,
so that put a hold on our reining training, and I never really brought him back to it. So,
goodness. Well,
my career sort of stopped there.
Yeah, he might not have been the best candidate for that. I don't know, but tripping happens. Tripping happens on the air. Well, and I know that you said you were going to make an announcement today about something new that you're doing at Self Made Farms, and what is that?
Well, up until now, I've always only been training my personal show horses, which a lot of people didn't know that. They thought that I was training outside horses, but I haven't been. But as of today, I will be accepting outside horses and training.
That is fantastic. That is fantastic. So this is a good time for you to tell us how people can get in touch with you.
Definitely. We have a website. It's selfmadefarm.com. And if you'll go up there, you can see pictures of the farm and pictures of some of our horses. And you can email us from there. It's got our phone number, our address, everything you would need is right there on our website. We also have a Facebook page, which is just titled Self-Made Farm, and you can get in touch with us through that as well.
All right, so selfmadefarm.com. Is that farm or farms? Just farm?
Just farm. We only have one.
All right, selfmadefarm.com, and then the Facebook page, Self-Made Farm. And so be sure and check that out, and you can get in touch with Jesse that way. What type of training, Jesse, are you going to be doing? Is it going to be primarily for the show, or will you be training for the different programs in versatility?
It'll be, we do a little bit of everything. We train horses just for the rail showing, all flat shod horses, and then we also do train for the different versatility events. It mostly depends on what the owner's goals are and, where they want to go with the horse. And we try to pay attention to what that horse is good at. And if they're good at something and their owner likes it, we try to pursue that and just make each horse the best at what they like to do.
All right. Well, that's exciting. So we'll be looking for more of the horses that you've been training in the show ring this coming year. So that will be exciting. And also the versatility classes that are going to be coming up. And so that will be an exciting new addition to Self-Made Farm. So congratulations on that and good luck in that endeavor. I know that you'll do well with that. Talk to us a little bit about your involvement with the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders and Exhibitors Association. And I know that you have been a director. Talk a little bit about how you got involved in that and what your involvement is with the association.
Okay. Well, I joined as a youth when we got our first walking horse, and I participated in the versatility program and a little bit in the distance program. And then I was a youth ambassador, and I was a member of the youth board of directors. And then once I became an adult, every year after the World Versatility Show, I would send in probably about a page of suggestions for the show. And some of them would be used, and some weren't. So I decided that since I had all these ideas, I might as well just try to get more involved. So I ran for the board of directors. I was actually the first alternate, but due to health reasons, one of the directors resigned, and I made it onto the board, and that was last year. And then this year, I decided to get more involved and make a run for the executive committee as the pleasure horse director. So usually when I get involved with something, I just can't stop, so and I just keep going because I'm a firm believer that you can't complain about something if you're not involved in it. So I decided to get involved and change what I could and hopefully grow the program and help the association. So,
well, congratulations on your new position as the vice president for the Pleasure Horse Division. And I know that you'll bring some great ideas to that position. What type of things would you like to see changed or added to or improved on with the pleasure division? Do you have any pet projects?
Well, I think I do a little bit. The World Versatility Show is obviously it's very important to me. I think it's a great venue to show everybody what all our horses can do, and a lot of people are really surprised at what the walkers can do. Funny story, in college I went to Ireland for 2 weeks in a study abroad project, and I knew they weren't going to know anything about walking horses, so I took videos and magazines so I could show them all the pictures, and the first thing that our Irish riding instructor asked me was, well, can they jump? So I assured her that they were athletic and that they could jump, and that as much as they love to ride out all over Ireland, that walking horses would be perfect for them.
Right.
So, I think that I want to get it out there to everyone, the usefulness of the horse and the versatility of it, and how it really can be a horse for everyone, even if everyone has different ideas of what they want to do with that horse. But I think, you know, something big that we really need to do is just reach out to everyone. I know a lot of people involved with the walkers feel like Middle Tennessee is just the nutshell of where everything is going on, and there's a little bit of a disconnect if you're outside of that area. So I definitely want to reach out to our members that are further away and make sure that they feel included with, you know, programs that they can participate in without having to travel to Middle Tennessee. So, and we have a lot of programs like that, you know, and I think the big thing is just making sure that everyone's aware of them.
Right, right. Well, and of course, we just had Alan Hill on, who's with Backcountry Horsemen of America. Can you talk to us a little bit about the program that we just put together with Backcountry Horsemen of America with the Breeders Association?
Sure. And that was mostly Rick Weiss's project, which he was the pleasure horse director before me. And he got together with Backcountry Horsemen, and they've put together a program where you can nominate a member of Backcountry Horsemen who is riding a registered Tennessee walking horse, and you can nominate them to receive an award for riding their Tennessee walking horse. And I believe the nominations are due
February the 20th.
Here.
Yeah, yes. February the 20th, I think, is when those are due. And you can go to the breeder's website, that's twhbea.com, and go to the program section on the website, and you can find the forms there that you can complete and to submit. And again, those need to be submitted by February the 20th. So we would encourage people to get involved with that, because there's some nice recognition to be involved. And we're certainly pleased to have put together an association with Backcountry Horsemen of America. It's important to keep the trails open. And we have many, many people that strictly enjoy their Tennessee walking horses for pleasure and trail use. So we want to encourage people to get involved with that program with Backcountry Horsemen of America and get involved in your area to help keep these trails open as well. So anyway, well, there are going to be some exciting things that I think are going to be coming up this year for you. And we want to take another quick break. And when we come back, we're going to visit one more time with Jesse for some closing thoughts. But I don't know what part of the country that you're in, but we're looking for snow here in Middle Tennessee. And I'd much prefer to see it rain. Templeton Thompson did a song called Ride Before It Rains. We're going to listen to that. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we'll be back in just a moment.
The lightning and heard the thunder. It's not that I don't want you around, but this time I'm not gonna drag you under. Think I better ride before it rains. Think I better saddle up my fastest pony. Thank you.
With Templeton Thompson, and you're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we are just pleased to have had Alan Hill with us today with Backcountry Horsemen of America, and Jessie LeBeck, who has been joining us from North Carolina. She has self-made farms there, our self-made farm, and is the new vice president for the Pleasure Horse Division with the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders and Exhibitors Association. And Jessie, we've just had a fun time talking with you today. Let me ask you, do you have any, what are your personal goals?
Well, one of mine is I need to win a world championship before I'm satisfied.
And
okay. One of my biggest goals is just to grow our barn and the training part of our barn. I really enjoy sharing the walking horse with people. I've met a lot of people that have just anything about the breed, and once I start telling them about them, I convince them that they're the greatest breed that there is, which is what I believe. So I just want to see the walking horse breed grow and become as popular as it can, and I want everybody on a walking horse.
All right. Well, we look forward to working with you this year in the Pleasure Horse Division being involved in some things there. We're just tickled to death to have you on the show today, and we want to wish you again the best of luck in your new endeavor as you open your training facility there. We look forward to seeing you back here in Middle Tennessee at some of the shows, and certainly look forward to watching you at the World Versatility Show this year. So thanks so much for joining us. And how's your weather out in North Carolina?
Well, cold and rain so far. So the song you played just a minute ago was very appropriate because I'll be trying to ride before it rains here.
All right. All right. Well, listen, you have a great day. Have a great new year. This is the year of the horse, and so we hope it's a successful year for you and everything that you do. So thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
Look forward to talking with you soon.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, we've had a fun show today. I think some great information from our guests that we've had that have joined us. Again, Alan Hill was with us with Backcountry Horsemen of America, and we encourage people to get involved in that. And again, thanks to Jessie for joining us to talk about her role with the Tennessee Walking Horse Breeders and Exhibitors Association and share her plans both personally and with the association. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we're live every Thursday at noon Central Standard Time. Next week, we have a great show lined up for you. We're going to have Bryn Hill, who will be joining us. He'll be visiting with us at the Campfire Cafe, and we'll be sharing his music and talking with Bryn as he visits with us next Thursday. And also, Tina Mae Weber will be joining us. And she's a fascinating young woman who has Great trail skills. She loves to get out on the trail. She was involved with the American Competitive Trail Horse Association, so we'll be talking about that. She also has designed saddles, and she has another business that she has started, so we'll be visiting with Tina May next Thursday at noon, Central Standard Time, on Equestrian Legacy Radio. So thanks for joining us for our first show of the year. And we wish you wings, and we remind you that if you climb in the saddle, get ready for the ride. Thanks for listening.
Learn to let go.